This episode is sponsored in part by Interoptic, a data interconnect company. You can purchase high-performance optics designed by engineers who truly understand what you need at a fraction of the cost. It's time to take control of your optics purchase with Interoptic. Interoptic is at Interop 2018 in Vegas, and you can check them out online at interoptic.com.
Today on the Priority Queue, we're going to hide some information. Oh, like route summarization, you might think? Sure, like route summarization, that's an example of information hiding. But there's so much more to the story than that, and our guest today is Russ White. Russ is a serial networking book author, network architect, RFC writer, patent holder, technical instructor, and much of the motive force behind the early iterations of the CCDE program. And he's many other things to the networking community as well, including part of the triumvirate leading the Network Collective, along with Jordan Martin and Yvonne Sharp, both of whom you've heard on the Packet Pushers before. And for more about Russ, check out rule11.tech and thenetworkcollective.net. Now, I mentioned that Russ is a serial networking book author, and the latest tome to flow from his keyboard, and mine actually, is Computer Networking Problems and Solutions, available on Amazon right now. And while I wrote or contributed to several chapters in the book, Russ did the lion's share of the work, and we're going to dive into one of his book chapters devoted to the topic of information hiding. Hello, Russ. How you doing?
I think you have downplayed your role dramatically. I'm sad.
It's kind of you to say. It's kind of you to say that you put it that way. Folks, I'll tell you, if you ever have an opportunity to get involved in a project with Russ, just be prepared to grab hold of the whirlwind, harness it, and then go. That's just the way it happens. So it was an experience trying to keep up with you.
Yvonne says that there is an event horizon toward the work vortex.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Good way to put it. So right. I mean, Russ, we did write a book together. We did most of the writing over spring and summer 2017. The book came out in early, December, I guess, of 2017.
Yep. Which was really cool because, you know, I work with a lot of people, and I must say, Ethan, you're actually really, really one of the best authors I've worked with, co-authors I've worked with. So
I couldn't keep up with your pace. I appreciate that you're saying that. I did try to keep up with what I promised you I'd do, but it was tough. You write a lot and write fast.
I mean, I don't want to offend anybody else I've co-authored books with, though.
So on our book, Computer Networking Problems and Solutions, we've gotten early tweets from many of you that have bought and read the book, some LinkedIn messages, some Amazon reviews, and all of those have been positive so far. We really appreciate that. That's great feedback for us. And again, it is available on Amazon. So Russ, I wanted to get your take on this. Some people have asked me, ebook or the paper book? I mean, I have a take on it. I just wondered if you had an opinion.
Since I like to drink a lot of Starbucks, not coffee, by the way, I don't drink coffee. I think you should get both. No. So I don't know. Technical books are hard. Yeah. I tend to read philosophy and fiction on ebook format by and large because there's not a lot of diagrams and a lot of formulas. I think for a technical book, it might actually be better to have the physical book just because you can see the diagrams and stuff. Now, you know,
that's exactly my take. Yeah, the ebook, and I've got both. I have a small Kindle screen. It's a Voyage device, and you can see the diagrams on there. But there are a lot of diagrams in this book, and then so if you're trying to look at them and looking at them on a small Kindle screen is better if you're using a Kindle on like your desktop or something like that. Then you can expand them a bit more. But then there's that opportunity to scribble down notes. These kind of things is maybe more helpful in a paper book. So,
Yep. That's why I read most philosophy and other stuff in electronic format because I have to take notes.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a lot easier to do that in a Kindle or ebook of whatever kind, whether it's PDF or whatever it is. Yeah.
Well, all right. Now, the format of this book that we're talking about here, Problems and Solutions, the format is exactly that. We talk about a variety of problems that are common in the networking world, and then the solutions that are in existence to address those problems. The idea is if you understand the problem and begin looking at the solutions, you'll see commonalities across the different solutions that are there, and they should be less intimidating. It's not all brandy new technology that's radically different one from another. A lot of times there's so many similarities that if you understand one, you probably have a pretty good understanding of another similar technology that goes after the same problem space.
Yeah, that's rule 11, right? RFC 1925, rule 11. Everything that's ever been invented will be invented again. If you know your scriptures, it's Ecclesiastes. It's exactly the same thing. We just put it in technology terms, which is all cool. And problems and solutions. I think, you know, the really crucial thing about this format is we as engineers don't do this. We, so, okay. Ethan's like, wait, what? What'd you just say? So, we tend to move from requirements to hardware and implementation. It's like native in our world. Like, oh, I'm going to go gather the requirements and go do and go buy equipment to solve that and implement features. And I think that the mindset of moving from problems to solutions is much more fruitful, much more interesting to say, what problem am I trying to solve? Not just business problem, but what technical problem am I trying to solve? And what are the available solutions? And then think, what technologies can I use to, you know, what technologies solve that kind of problem? And then finally, once you've done all that, you say, well, what features might actually implement those technical solutions, right? Not, we jump. We jump way too fast between those two things.
It's so easy to go to the problem, having a certain kind of a problem, going to the solution that we used before that worked. And so this sounds more or less the same. So I'm just going to order up some of those switches, load balancers, firewalls, whatever the case may be. Yeah. Well, yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Russ, I was hoping we could dive into something that I think a lot of folks maybe feel like they got a pretty good handle on, information hiding. Now, there's a ton of topics in this book. I mean, there's really a lot of topics in this book. We had scope creep, Russ. We had significant scope 30, creep.
33 chapters.
Out of an original plotted 20 or 21, right? It did get big. But information hiding is an interesting one to me in that you can, as a network engineer who's gone up through lots of training, think if I am aggregating routes, that's information hiding, and that's most of what I need to know probably. But in fact, there's a good bit more thinking that can go into this.
yeah, well, that's where most people stop, right? I've done my aggregation. I did my area range command in OSPF. I'm done. Not really.
So let's get into some reasons here about. Let's do it like the book does. We talk about some problems and then get into some solutions. So let's spend some question time talking about problems. First of all, why would we ever want to hide information from a control plane, Russ? Because logically, you go, isn't it better if I have more granular, more detailed information? Why would I want to hide information?
Yeah, define better. That's the problem. So most of the time, if you're trying to get optimal routing, if you're trying to get traffic to flow most optimally through the network, it is better not to hide information. We have this argument all the time on data center fabrics. Go look at the entire argument over Rift versus Open Fabric versus LSVR versus, using BGP versus using EIGRP or whatever the case might be. By the way, I'll just be heretical and say EIGRP is an ideal data center fabric protocol and just leave it there for people to go ponder that.
I'd have to think about that one. That's interesting. Okay.
Okay. Or Babel, as the case may be. But So, you know, there are situations where you don't want to hide information, but by and large, the problem you're trying to solve is along the lines of resource conservation, right? I have a small, I'm going to show my age. I have a Cisco 800.
Oh my.
sitting on a shelf. I don't even know what you would replace that with now. That's pretty sad. But anyway, a Cisco 800, probably some type of ISR, sitting on some closet in a DMARC or sitting on a shelf in a DMARC in some office. And how much memory does it have? It doesn't have very much. So you have to hide information from that device because there's just a control plane constraint there, right? There was a time when I worked on a project where there's some patents that came out of this called Adopt a Mac Hack, where we, Ethan's like, what is he talking about? where there were actually multiple hosts that could use the same MAC address because there were switching table size requirements and things like that. So resource conservation. Another one is, I'm just following your notes here, Ethan.
Which follows your chapter. So well, it's inception, okay. My friend.
It's to create multiple failure domains, right? And how do you determine what's a failure domain? In my mind, when I think of a failure domain, what I'm going to think of is what is the set of devices that have to recalculate something when something in the network changes, whatever that something is, whether it's best paths to something, to a particular destination, or whether it's the set of available destination, things like that. So that's another reason, is because you're trying to reduce the number of devices that need to recalculate when there's a change in the network, right? Hmm. So that is reduction of failure domain, reducing the blasts. And that's actually a common way of saying it. I was just reading a Google research doc the other day or yesterday that talked about reducing the blasts. Same kind of concept. Network attack surface is a really good one.
So, yeah, and that's an interesting one to me, because it's not immediately obvious when you say attack surface. So yeah, dive into that.
Right. Attack surface. So if you think about your attack surface, what is your attack surface? It's the number of places something can be attacked in your network. And although we like to say obscurity is not security, by the way, and I think that's a very valid thing in some situations, but nonetheless, there are times when the attacker, not knowing how something is built, is actually slowing the attacker down. Okay, look, you're never going to stop a determined attacker. Okay, just not going to happen. Not going to happen with your house. Not going to happen with your network. But if you can slow them down while they figure out how things are built, then you can see what they're doing and counter the attack, and you can be active in your defense. So there's some sense in which this reduces the attack surface.
So in this case, when we're talking about network attack surface and information hiding, you know, and this is one of the things I wanted to clarify with you, would you put NAT, or I should say PAT, into that group?
Oh, you went there. Oh my goodness. They did a whole show on it, Network Collective, and I wasn't a part of the show. So I guess I get to say it now. Yeah, I think that I'll be heretical again and say that I think that PAT and NAT are valid ways to help reduce your attack surface. Are they security mechanisms on their own? No. Do they provide real security? No. Would you deploy NAT and say I'm done, or PAT and say I'm done? No. But could you add curtains to your house as a way of helping discourage attackers from coming to your house? Yeah, you could, right?
No, we completely agree here. This is when you use NAT or PAT more typically, some kind of a NAT overload situation, there is a lot of information hidden behind that an attacker doesn't know and really can't be inferred. You are truly blind because that information isn't there for you to scope out. It's not on the public internet. You've got a boundary router that is hiding that information. So certainly, yeah. So the question came up, Russ, in my mind, in that a lot of this book we talk about routing and forwarding tables, and certainly we talk about security plenty in the book, but just in the context here, wanted to make sure when we're talking about reducing attack surface that was in the loop, along with aggregating routes and some of the other things we're going to talk about here.
Yeah, and another thing that reducing the attack surface can do from a routing perspective is if you get off of the data plane and you start thinking about the control plane, right? I start thinking I can actually attack a network by trying to flap a route or make a route appear to be flapping. Like I can inject at your BGP edge a flapping route as an attacker and consume resources. It's a form of DDoS. Well, if I'm aggregating routes, the flapping goes away.
Yes.
Right? So in some sense, I'm also managing the control plane, the amount of information I'm allowing into the control plane, the rate at which state changes, which can reduce a particular kind of attack surface. It's not one we often think about, but I've actually seen it in the wild. I've actually seen people flap routes.
Hmm. Another point that I liked here about why you would want to hide information is to prevent positive feedback loops that can kill a network completely. Now, I thought this was interesting because at first, if you don't know what you're about to read, you think positive feedback loops. Positive. Sounds good. Sounds fun. I like positive things. Positive is nice. But of course, what we're getting at here with positive feedback loops is kind of an aggregation of information going round and round that a control plane has to deal with such that the number of events that are being dealt with overwhelms the control plane. It can no longer process those events, and you're dead in the water. So I think a very common illustration of that would be Any sort of what we might call a broadcast storm, do it a topology loop or a bridging loop where the broadcasts and other network-specific events that a network control plane must process, it's never getting smaller because it's seeing them over and over and over again. And eventually, the CPU is at 100%. The network can no longer converge because the routing protocols have no CPU left in which they can maintain stability. And you are dead in the water. And the blast zone there can be anywhere from a very small loop to the entirety of a data center, if depending on how your VLAN design looks like.
That's right. Yeah, and I think positive feedback loops are hard for people to get their heads around sometime, because we don't really deal with it as network engineers as much as you would as an electronic engineer or an audio engineer, right? We're all familiar with the audio form of the positive feedback loop. We just don't think of it as that what it is.
Yeah, right. The microphone feeds, going to the speaker, which feeds the microphone, and then then you get that big awful sound.
That's exactly right. I think you need to put that in as a sound effect. Everybody would turn off the podcast right here and go, "No, never again by listening to that." But yeah, so. Yeah, I mean, and so we don't really think about this, but there are two aspects of this that are pretty interesting. The first is that the positive feedback loop is caused because of state change, rapid state change that actually increases itself over time, right? So you take a state change, it becomes amplified, and the state change amplified, it gets amplified again through the loop and blah, 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 blah. So one thing that you're doing with aggregation is you're stopping that amplification of state change. The other side of that, though, is every time you aggregate, you're actually removing information, which in turn can actually cause a positive feedback loop, which is really weird, right?
Yeah, I read that three times, I think, going through that, and it's a little tricky to go through that process. I mean, I think that you describe that in the book. It's kind of a rare circumstance, but
It is. I mean, specifically the instance I'm thinking of is when you're redistributing between two routing protocols and your external metrics are not containing the internal metrics in a way so that you end up losing your shortest path information, essentially. And when you do that, you can create a permanent routing loop that then feeds on itself through traffic patterns and causes a network failure. Again, I've seen this in the real world, but it's not something you expect.
I got thrown into a change about a week after I got hired on a fairly large network. And this was in my earlier days. And the project was what you're describing. It was a mutual route redistribution between an EIGRP and an OSPF domain, if I remember right.
Almost always EIGRP and another protocol.
Metrics and AD were not set up in such a way that this was ever going to work. And so what was happening was you'd see protocols come up, routes begin to be fed, reconvergence would occur, then the adjacencies would go back down, and it would just churn away like this, because as new information was learned, kind of like the recursive tunnel problem.
Tunnel problem is another one, kind of, right? Because a tunnel is an abstraction, form of abstraction. So you're actually, right, you know, you're building a bad situation when you have a recursive tunnel. So of course.
Okay, now there's another big concept I wanted to make sure we get across here, and that is the topology information hiding versus reachability information hiding. And you make a big deal of contrasting those. They're not the same thing, topology information versus reachability information. You want to explain the difference there.
So, and actually this is something that's often not ever talked about. Ever. I find very few people think about this, but the difference is you can hide reachability for a specific destination without hiding topology. That's very rare. I don't know of anybody who does that. There used to be a thing called atomic aggregate in BGP that would do that, which is really strange.
I remember that from way back in the CCIE study days. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's still there. But I don't know anybody who uses atomic aggregate. We're just talking about it in the free range routing. And I don't know anybody who actually uses it, but it is out there. Wherein you actually maintain your topology information, even though you're aggregating the routes, which means you're actually taking a /24, making it into a 22, but you're actually maintaining your topology information with the aggregate attribute or aggregate. Yeah. Like the atomic aggregate attribute, which is weird, but this is a thing in BGP. So, but normally what you see is you see either you remove the topology information or you remove the reachability information or you do both. And most of the time it's both. I'm sorry, it's either both or it's just topology. It's never you remove reachability without topology. So the classic example is the OSPF flooding a main boundary, which is I can, when I do a flooding domain boundary, people think I'm aggregating stuff when I do a flooding domain boundary. That's not really true. I'm summarizing the topology, but every reachable destination still exists as an independent reachable destination.
But you don't know the link topology to go through that domain hop by hop and link by link. Right. That's all hidden from you. It looks like one thing. Yeah.
Right. It looks like the destination is now attached directly to the ABR.
Yeah.
As if it were just a leaf, like a directly connected network off the ABR. That's what it looks like from the graph perspective. So you've lost that topology information out in that outlying area, but you still know every reachable destination. Every network out there is still an individual network. So then what happens is you go into OSPF and you do area range, and now you're actually taking the /24, making it into its /22. So now you've removed reachability, which means you can actually lose one of the /24s that are contained within a /22, and you still advertise the /22 as if it exists.
And I think that's what most people think of. Oh, I'm aggregating routes. I'm hiding reachability information. That's
right,
because that's what typically a lot of people do with their boundaries. They're trying to control the number of routes that appear in the core. You know, simplify them.
Right.
So they'll summarize routes. Yeah.
Yes. So an interesting instance of this is a type 5 or a type 7, well, a type 5 or a type 7. Sorry, I shouldn't use the type numbers. Externals in OSPF, where the ABR actually creates essentially a host route to the ASBR so you gain back some of the topology information you've lost at the ABR. People don't think about that, but that's really what's going on.
It is. Right? Yeah, that's exactly what's going on. Yeah. Again, it's another corner case, and the book is fun. When I was going through this chapter reviewing this, you do dive into some of the oddball corner cases that can turn up in certain circumstances, which is a good reminder of what can happen. And also talks about how long you've been around, Russ.
Cisco 800s, man. No, I'm older than Cisco 800s.
Want to know. So here's another question for you that pops up. When designing a network, how critical do you think convergence time is and why, and then what times matter? So the context here is microloops. We were talking about, there's a section in the book where you get into convergence, the problem of microloops, where there's some amount of time it's going to take during a change in network topology for every router that is a part of that network domain to converge. So
right.
how critical is the time? Are we talking about seconds or fractions of a second, milliseconds? Where is the time frame that is important for us to consider as network designers?
Yeah, now this is where it comes down to your application load and what you're actually doing in your network. And as we move into a more of a microservices world, convergence time becomes a lot more important. And the reasoning is this, is that used to, you had a single application, and maybe that application went to a database. And so you had maybe two drops in the domino chain, right? If you think of it as a domino chain, I have two things in my domino chain. I have three things, and maybe four things, because maybe I have an application running on a PC, and that's talking to a middleware guy, and that middleware guy is talking to a server that's running an application that's talking to like a database backend or something. So somewhere in that range, you might have four hops in the application for the information flow end to end. In a microservices world, I have a web server. It's sitting up there as a front end, and it's gathering information from, you know, five or six business backend servers. And then those business backend servers are gaining information from 1,000 or more backend servers behind them that are each in a chain. So now I have this huge domino chain. And when I push one domino over and it all falls over, the time at which those dominoes fall over make a big difference in the overall execution of the chain itself. Does that make sense? Maybe I said that all wrong.
No, it does, because well, you hit it right in the beginning, I think, the most important point, which is it depends on your application and the architecture how much these convergence times are relevant. So for certain apps, it won't matter. For other apps, it'll matter more. And then when you get into the specific architecture of the application, the different calls that are being made, you mentioned microservices. Boy, when you get into that structure for an application, the number of calls that are being made, who the different components are that are making the calls to one another to finally end up with an answer that is returned to the user can be very complicated. And so anything in that dependency chain, anything in that the domino set of dominoes there that breaks down can severely impact. It could go as dramatic as the user doesn't get an answer to users waiting a long time. If you're servicing hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of users, it can have a pretty wide impact. I guess if it's only a few people, maybe it doesn't hurt that bad. So
Exactly. So it depends on your application, how long that matters. And the way the convergence event shows up also depends on the way the application's tuned its timers, right? So in some cases, a convergence event shows up as just jitter in a voice over IP stream. It's fast enough, right?
Yes.
Sometimes it shows up as a total failure in the connection. It depends on how that application is set up and what that convergence time looks like. So you have to be cognizant of that as a network engineer and tune your network around that, those types of things.
Yeah, and that can be tough the bigger your network is. If you've got hundreds of switches that are making up the potential paths that a microservice call could go, this goes back to telemetry and needing really good telemetry. But we're getting off the mark a little bit.
Well, from a designer's perspective, right, maybe you even go to the point of saying, I'm going to have a fixed delay network, which sounds totally contrary to packet switching. How would you ever have a fixed delay network in a packet switch network? But you can come pretty close if you know what you're doing with design. And that's where most of the hyperscalers are today.
Well, with leaf spine, you can. Is that where you're going?
Yeah,
where you've got, you know, leaf between spine. Leaf spine and leaf, you've got, if they're all designed the same, the speeds are the same, you can get as bonkers as cable length the same. You end up with a pretty well-known amount of port-to-port time, I guess, going through the fabric.
Right. And then you go to 1RU boxes and you get away from chassis boxes because the chassis backplane becomes unpredictable and you can't see it. Yeah. Right. So these are all the things that you start thinking about when you think about high speed trading networks, and you start thinking about the number of processors over the number of ports and all the buffering delays and stuff like that. But yeah, you can get pretty close. So convergence time can be really critical. It just really depends on the application.
Okay, so back to the issue of convergence times then. So we've established that they are important. It is application specific how important they are and where you need to tune for. So let's go back to information hiding now. How does information hiding factor into control plane convergence times?
So go back to your definition of what the blast radius or the failure domain is, right? How many devices have to recalculate based on a change? Whatever that change happens to be. So the fewer the changes, the faster the network's going to converge. So in EIGRP, for instance, we used to measure this in the lab. And, you know, I just keep bringing up EIGRP. Ethan, I'm sorry. I know it's one of those things.
I like EIGRP. I've run a couple of pretty sizable ones. If you know how to tune it, it's a good thing. Just avoid those stuck inactives.
Well, yeah, exactly. So, but the cool thing about EIGRP is it's so measurable compared to like ISIS or OSPF in many ways, or BGP is also measurable this way as well. You know, there was a time when Daniel Walton had BGP up in the lab and he was testing things, and we could actually calculate how long it would take for BGP to converge. We could actually tell you based on the min route advertisement interval and the number of AS hops maximum to the new, or maximum to the current, exactly how long that BGP network was going to take to converge. And we could be right within a couple of milliseconds, a couple of hundred milliseconds anyway. With the EIGRP, it's much the same. If I know how many hops the query range is, typically it's about 250 milliseconds convergence time per hop, just the way it is. Hmm. So the more you hide information, the more you block the query range, the faster the network is going to converge. I mean, it's a direct correlation in a distance vector or a path vector protocol.
You don't know the answer to this question. Why do I need to ask you this question? Because you don't know the answer to it. You don't have this route.
Exactly.
That lost. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. It's harder in a link state protocol to visualize that, right? It's just more difficult because it's everybody's computing in parallel and the flooding is different. So it's a little harder to visualize that and understand, but it's really hard to or really easy to see in a distance vector protocol like EIGRP, because it's just straight up, where's the information going? 250 milliseconds per hop. Now I know what my convergence time is roughly going to be. Don't quote me on the 250 milliseconds. That's an old lab number.
Sure.
But, yeah. You know, at that time, that's what it was.
Well, all right, Russ, we've talked about a lot of the problems and gotten into the solutions a little bit, but we're going to dive into the solutions a little more. So if the problems that that are driving information hiding would be resource conservation, splitting up our failure domains, controlling that blast radius that we can have with when different bad things happen, reducing our network attack surface, so security is an application there, and then preventing those positive feedback loops like the mic and the speaker feeding back into each other, making a whole lot of noise, that sort of an illustration. Those are the things that information hiding is.
Where's your sound effect button?
Right.
Hey, listeners, this is Drew from the Packet Pushers, taking a few seconds from the podcast to talk to you about one of today's sponsors, Interoptic. Demand from the edge, 5G, and IoT are coming. If you're not doing optics correctly, you're going to pay for it later. Interoptic understands you're going to need a more nimble layer zero, and they support the full range of products you need today and don't yet know you'll need tomorrow. Layer zero is more important than ever, so learn how to spec your optics so your network environment can scale with your bandwidth demands. Stop paying OEM prices for optics and start talking to the optics experts who deliver brand equivalent transceivers at a fraction of the price. And don't be fooled by lesser optics. The difference between generic, third-party, and brand equivalent optics matters. You can purchase the same, if not better performing optics at a fraction of the cost. And they're designed by engineers who truly understand what you need. It's time to take control of your optics purchase with InterOptic. You can visit InterOptic at InterOp 2018 in Vegas to learn how they can help you spec the right optics for your custom network environment and find out more today at interoptic.com. Now back to the podcast.
So let's get into the solutions and in some more detail. Again, we've hinted at it. Let's dive in more. Now, there's really two major ways we can handle information hiding. That we can apply information hiding to. We can limit the scope of information that the control plane knows about. And the other one would be limit the speed at which the control plane is asked to process events. So we keep control of that CPU. So if you don't know about something, you don't have to deal with it. And if you don't have so many events you got to deal with, you can keep the CPU under control. So can you give us a little more detail on the scope and speed notions just to make sure we got a full conversation of what we're talking about?
Yeah, scope is the one everybody thinks about. Topologically scope. Well, that's the one everybody tends to think about is scope, topological scope, which is, this concept of I'm going to do aggregation or summarization. I'm going to do summary range and OSPF, or I'm going to build ISIS flooding domains and just not leak routes, or I'm going to do aggregate address and BGP or whatever the case might be. So that is typically how you manage scope of information. The speed is the one we often don't think about, which is pretty interesting to me because we spend a lot of time when I was in engineering at the big company that I won't mention. No, I guess it doesn't matter if I mention them. Anyway, when I was engineering at Cisco and when I was in engineering at Ericsson, actually, thinking through how do you manage the speed at which state is pushed into the router? Control plane policing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very, very simple example, right?
I would say it's not so simple, but sure, go ahead. I mean, simple in what it does, fair enough.
It's something we don't think of as hiding information, but that's what it is. It's hiding information.
Because it's throttling the rate at which certain kinds of packets are making it into the control plane. If you get an excessive rate of packets, but beyond a certain bit rate, then those packets are dropped and the control plane never sees them. So, right, information hiding there. I want to critique control plane policing as complex in that. Getting it right is one of those things where if you weren't running it and you want to add it to your network, it's like, oh, gosh, especially in your production environment.
No, it's hard. It's really hard to get control plane policing right, unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever. I mean, it's just one of those things. working on it was, it's very difficult to figure out. So another thing that we don't think about is LSA timers in OSPF or ISIS, right? Or minimum broad advertising interval in BGP. And we, now it's not even so much that I'm actually there removing information. I'm actually bunching information up. So normally I might have an OSPF LSA generation every 10 milliseconds. They're telling OSPF, oh, no, only source these every 100 milliseconds or every 200 milliseconds or 1 second or whatever the case might be. So it's going to gather everything up into one bundle and send the bundle rather than sending. So it is actually a form of aggregation in a sense.
Storm control comes to mind as another one. I don't know if that's still terribly popular, but storm control is another where if you exceed a certain number of broadcasts over a certain rate that you define, those are discarded, and that can be used on a switch to hide information effectively. Or multicasts, or even unicasts, as I remember the different algorithms that the control plane might see, doesn't have to see it anymore.
That's right. Yeah. BGP update packing is exactly the same sort of thing from a time perspective, right? So there's all these places where we aggregate across time, but we don't think about it as aggregation, right? But that, and that's important to do. That's still important to do.
Well, there's a couple of things going on there. There's some like control plane policing or storm control. Those are discarding events. So it's not actually an aggregation of events. Right. It's a throttling of the rate of an event, meaning you're not going to see some, versus a timer interval where you're going to queue up a few events and then send them all at once so that the CPU can be idle for a certain amount of time. And then, I'm going to cycle up, process these events, cycle back down again.
Yep, yeah. That's exactly right. And what's interesting about that is that actually correlates to hiding topology information versus hiding reachability information. Hiding reachability information, I'm actually throwing information away, real information about reachability away. When I hide topology information, I'm throwing away metric information in a sense, but I'm almost more gathering stuff up. Maybe that's not a good example, but that's
I think we know what you mean. Yeah. Well, so we mentioned earlier summarizing topology information versus aggregating reachability information, and we explained the difference between those two using OSPF as an example. And so hopefully everybody's got that summarization, aggregation. If you're getting right down into Russ's brain, those words have very different meanings. Summarization, you're gonna preserve the metric and remove the link. Aggregation, you're going to preserve broad information like a supernet, remove specific information, i.e. a subnet. So slightly different things, or significantly different things, really, in Russ's term. But we talked
You just scared 75% of our listeners.
Well, honestly, Russ, I think some of that, those definitions are personal, where depending on who you're talking to, it gets down to, well, what do you mean by that? Oh, I'm summarizing routes. Well, you meant you're aggregating reachability. So it just gets down to understanding what's in everybody's mind, and maybe you got to break out a whiteboard marker once in a while. But there's another technique. There's another technique we haven't talked about, Russ, which is filtering reachability information. So can you explain filtering and how that's different from aggregation?
So filtering is just removing the information altogether, right? But it's difficult because quite often when you're filtering, you're not actually filtering. You're actually filtering out more specific information. So you're actually aggregating.
I don't think that helped anybody. So let me back up.
Well, we can now just move to the next topic here.
So here's an interesting one. Within an OSPF area, for example, there is no such thing as filtering a route. That route, that LSA, is got to be consistent for every OSPF router that is in that area. So you can't actually make that route disappear.
You can't filter. Now you can filter routes in OSPF, but you're filtering them between the LSDB, between the database and the routing table, which is what people don't understand.
Right.
I mean, the route is still there, but you're just taking it out of the routing table.
Which is why it is a locally significant event. That route's still going to be, everyone's going to have that in their link state database, and it would have to be a device-by-device thing that you're doing, a filter that you're applying to prevent it from showing up in the FIB. Yeah.
That's correct. So let's take an example for OSPF, since we're using OSPF. Ethan, I don't know how we got on OSPF, but we'll just use OSPF. It's okay. So OSPF has this cool filtering technique called type 3 filtering, which is filtering routes out of. So again, when I come out of an area, flooding domain, using ISIS terms, a flooding domain, using OSPF terms, an area, an outlying area, and I come into an ABR, an area border router, I take those things and I take all the topology information off of the routes and I make them appear to be directly connected to the ABR. A type 3, for anybody who thinks about OSPF, the simplest way to think about a type 3 is it's just a type 1. It's just another type 1.
The thing to remember is we're dealing with more than one area here. That's pretty key to this conversation.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So a type 3 is effectively a type 1, except it's all the routes that are not directly connected to me. And a type 1 is all the routes that are directly connected to me.
Inter versus intra area. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So I take this stuff, I attach it to my local router, and I'm going to be able to send out all of these routes. Now, let's say that I have a /22 that's also covered by a /24. There is absolutely no reason that I cannot filter the /24 out of the type 3, because the 24 is still reachable as part of the /22.
Yep.
In IPv4 terms, right? So that is technically aggregation, even though you're using filtering to do it.
Yes.
Okay.
And again, this example is different from the filtering we were talking about earlier between rib and fib. This is a very different thing, but just
right. Yeah, this is so a very no different one's conflating thing. Right. But now, if I have a server that should only be reachable in area 51, let's say, or area 50, or whatever area that you're in, and I don't want anybody else on the network to ever be able to reach it, I can use type 3 filtering and remove that reachability information entirely from the network. It's the same implementation technique, but it's two different effects. One is truly filtering. I'm taking the information out. It is no longer reachable. In the other case, it's still reachable, but it's reachable because of a covering route that's coming from some other place, like a default or whatever the case might be. So,
and again, going back to why we would be doing this, one of the reasons is this is a solution to help us keep control of that control plane, limit what a control plane has to know and act upon, limit how quickly events are hitting a control plane and keeping control of it. These are all solutions, techniques that are in your tool bag to solve certain of these problems.
And security-wise, now we've fallen directly into a specific example of a security situation where I have a server that should only be reachable at some remote site and not from off the site. It's an oil rig or a medical office or whatever the case might be. I can use type 3 filtering to reduce my attack profile by making it completely unreachable from outside that flooding domain.
Yes.
So, you know, that's an interesting example people don't think of quite often, but there is that as well.
And a much more boring example, not of security, but just why you do summarization sometimes to begin with. If you're in a stub area, which I'll define as, we don't have to talk about this in OSPF terms, but just broadly in routing, you've got a router that's hanging at the end of the domain. What does it really need to know? Does it need to have a fully populated routing table? Or could you get away with a default route because everything that it needs to know is going to go out the door one way? Why would you feed it a full routing table if it doesn't have a lot of choices? I used EIGRP stub, for example. Loved that feature. I'd make all my closet switches. I had layer 3 links up to a closet switch running EIGRP, make it a stub router. What's it need to know? Nothing. It needs to know a default route. It's a stub, so it knows. Now it's telling the rest of the EIGRP domain, I don't know nothing about nothing except what I'm announcing. That's it.
Well, yeah, and in the case of EIGRP, it actually blocks query range because now you're saying, I know nothing except what I'm announcing. I don't even know how to get to it. I'm not transit.
Right.
I don't even know.
Exactly. Like,
I don't even bother asking you. Because I don't know nothing, you know.
Which leads us into another good conversation point here, Russ. And some people wonder, well, my network's small. Do I have to worry about all this stuff? And I think the answer is a lot of times, yes. These are good practices that even if you've got a small network that's only got dozens or hundreds of routes, you can benefit from some of these techniques. It may save you some headache down the road. Scenarios that you didn't see. I think there's a line here where it's nice to have versus need to have, and perhaps with scale, you get to the need to have part. Do you have some take on that, Russ?
So I would say a couple of things there. The first is always remember that there's a trade-off when you remove information always. And sometimes you don't want to remove information. I would argue that you shouldn't be aggregating on data center fabric. Personally, I just think you shouldn't do that. But, you know, that's
well, data center fabric is different from, say, a campus network with a closet switch.
Right. Right, exactly. So think about what you're aggregating and what you're losing when you aggregate, right? But beyond that, yeah, I think you should build your network with aggregation in mind. You should just aggregate from day one and just think about how to split up failure domains. So what if you don't have failures that cause that right today? But still, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and you're trying to chase down a problem, it's awful nice to have those failure domains and know where you should see things certain ways, right?
Awful nice to have that foundation in place when your network is growing. So you have it in place from day one. Maybe it's not amazingly beneficial, but all of a sudden you acquire another company. Your company buys someone else and you need to map them into your template for how that network's to be laid out. Or you're just growing by leaps and bounds and you're adding new facilities or new data center pods or new computer rooms, as the case may be. If you've got a template that involves a good route summarization scheme, a good information hiding scheme, you can just put everybody into that scheme that you've already built rather than trying to scramble and figure it out when you've got pressure on to get connectivity flowing and traffic moving.
Yeah. Plan for growth.
For sure.
Always.
For sure.
And those aggregation points also give you joints. You can break the network up and play with things, right? Once you've already built those, then you can say, well, this campus over there, because I aggregated, I can put this new box in there and do a different architecture, and none of the rest of the network needs to know. And that actually makes my life a lot easier, right?
Yeah. Well, I think we see that with data center fabrics. Typically, you've got not always, but often you've got a couple of border switches that are just aggregating information about the data center network out into some core network where you're heading off to the WAN, heading off to the internet, and so on. Does the rest of the network need to know about everything going on in the data center fabric and vice versa? No.
Yeah, not at all, right? Because there's only two exit points out of that fabric or four or whatever case might be, depending on your design. Most of the time it's two, so I say two.
That's most typically what I've run into as well.
Most typically it's two. Yeah.
So another scheme here that actually applies very well to data center fabrics is layering control planes. This is another information hiding solution that gets covered in the book. And layering control planes, I think the easiest way to describe that would be overlay networks, where you've got an underlay network and then you've got an overlay network riding on top of it. You want to talk about that, Russ? Explain what layering control planes, what is really meant by that.
Yeah, so the classic case that people don't ever think about again is BGP on top of an IGP in a transit network.
Mm-hmm.
And so all you're doing is dividing your customer routes from your internal reachability so that changes in your customer routes don't impact internal reachability and IP peering session or BGP peering sessions. That's a very basic common thing that people do in transit networks, and we don't think about it as overlay, but it is. It's an overlay.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? You've got BGP at the edge, and then MPLS tag switching that is going to carry that traffic across, and they're not dependent one on another in that scenario.
Yeah. Even if you're not tunneling, I'm still separating my customer routes from my internal routes.
Yeah.
So I'm not segregating my traffic necessarily. I'm segregating my control plane information. Now, if I'm using MPLS and I'm doing internet in a VERF, then I'm segregating both, which is an even stronger example of the same concept. And then I carry that to an enterprise network. I don't like that word enterprise. I always have to say that. It's like a brand thing.
We know this about you. We know.
So if you carry that to any other operational environment, you still think in terms of, I'm going to lay an overlay on top of things, and my overlay is only going to contain enough of the topology to make the servers I want to talk to each other, which is a subset of the entire topology. In fact, it may be a total abstraction of the topology, right? In the overlay, it may look like I have one switch or one router, but there may be thousands underneath.
I was thinking of data center fabrics too. This can come into play. You've got VXLAN on top of whatever the underlay is. And if you look at the forwarding tables of the leaf and spine switches, they don't all look the same and they don't all know the same things and they don't need to. I know right. One scenario is you could have spine switches that pretty much know how to deliver traffic between VTEPs, VXLAN tunnel endpoints, and that's about right. It. Might be about all they need to know that, and maybe how to exit the fabric, if that. And then if you look inside of VXLAN and that domain, you've got another control plane effectively that knows a lot more information, depending on your VNIs and so on.
Right, right. But remember, when you layer things, you're actually building interaction surfaces as well, right? Because you now have a control plane on top of a control plane. So now you're going to have shared risk grouping, right? You're going to have SLRGs if you're talking about, or shared SRLGs if you're talking about links. But going beyond links, even for devices and stuff, you're going to have fate sharing for those underlying things. You break one router and you've broken 10 or 15 virtual topologies, or 100 or 1,000 or whatever the case might be.
Well, and then we can get into how you actually engineer a link or a leaf spine network to handle those sorts of issues. Because, by definition, you're supposed to be able to tolerate a spine switch can drop. Everybody's okay. We converge and you move on. Yeah,
that's exactly right. Spine switch should only drop 25% of your fabric capacity, or, you know, whatever it is, 12%, or depending on how big your spine layer is, right? Exactly. Yeah.
So a couple of corner cases that we categorized under the solutions here in ways that you can hide information. One of them, Russ, is caching. Now, this was complicated, I felt, when reading this. So I would appreciate it if you would talk through caching. It was very interesting, but also not immediately obvious how this was information hiding and how you can be victimized by it in a negative way.
Victimized by it. I like that, Ethan. So if you think about it, the simplest case is a spanning tree domain, right? I have 5,000 hosts connected to, say, 100 switches, or 10,000 hosts. Let's just say 10,000 hosts connected to 100 switches. Does every switch need to know every host as a destination? No, it depends on the traffic flows, right? So this is the whole concept of bridge learning in a spanning tree network. What you do is you learn as the traffic comes along, and you cache that information.
And you populate your bridging table with a MAC address. So the next time it comes through, the first time it's going to be unknown unicast flooding, and then now I know. And the next time he knows exactly what port to send that traffic out of.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a cache, right? But I can, if I have 100,000 devices that I'm caching for, I may not need a table that can support 100,000 entries. Because in theory, I'm only having 80-20 rule or some other rule. I may be able to get by with 20 or 30,000 table entries.
You don't need to know all the hosts all the time. You may need to know all the hosts some of the time, but 80-20 rule. Right. Yeah, you've got a finite amount of table space there.
Whatever that number is, right? Right. So that's basically how caches information hide, because you're essentially building subsets of the topology that know how to reach certain hosts. Not everybody in the network knows how to reach every host. They don't need to, right? Yep. So it's a subset. So that's really cool. It can save you a lot of forwarding table space. The difficulty is in what are called Mother's Day events, when everybody calls their mom. I mean, right?
All of a sudden, everybody needs to know about everybody at the same time.
And you built your cache to only, because you're caching for the reason that you don't want everybody to have to know about everybody, because you know your forwarding hardware can't support it. So now you end up with your cache overrunning, which can cause positive feedback loops, by the way, which then slam the network. I know this from firsthand experience, because I was in Cisco Tech when the fast cache failed.
But this feels, a couple of observations here. One, this feels like a rare problem, more of an L2 kind of problem as well. You know, more of a Ethernet MAC caching bridging table problem. Do you have a scenario where this would happen in the world of routing?
Cisco used to have fast cache, and fast cache was layer 3 forwarding. And
are we talking about the Ceph table or something else?
No, before Ceph. This was why Ceph was invented. was because the fast cache was a problem doing this. So, and in order to get ECMP to work correctly, if you think about it, even if I have a slash 24 or slash, you know, whatever in IPv4 space, and I should really be using V6, people are going to yell at me now because I didn't use V6
address. Well, you use V6 all over the book. I mean, so many examples in there are V6. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, there's actually an RFC about that, that you should use V6 examples where possible. I don't know the RFC number, but there's an RFC about it.
I didn't know that. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so yeah. So what would happen is because even if you have, say, a slash 24, you would get you would have ECMP. So you'd have 8 paths to get to that slash 24, 4 paths or whatever it is. And you would get packets for that destination for a slash 32 within that slash 24. But how do you actually spread traffic across the slash 20, across those different paths? Well, it's very difficult to do, right? I mean, you think a hash algorithm, but hash algorithm doesn't really work because I'm doing a destination-based lookup.
Yeah, it depends on the algorithm, what it is, how even of a distribution you get.
So what you do is you look up and you use your hash algorithm to assign the slash 32 to one of the ECMP links and you cache the slash 32. Okay, so now all of a sudden, a routing table that is 1,000 routes becomes actually, because it's a slash 16, 2 to the 16th destination host caches.
And oops. Okay, yeah. This is still kind of older architecture, though, right? I mean, are we drawing on an example from the past, or is this still the current problem we'd be concerned about?
Oh, no. This is an older architecture. Okay. You shouldn't see this in anything new. I mean, there are some cached situations today. You'll find some Broadcom chipsets that only have 100K routes available, and people will actually build the same sort of caching algorithm between their RIB and their FIB. And there are solutions to this problem around and out there floating. But by and large, it's just one of those cases where I think you're right. You'll almost always see this at layer 2, but it is possible at layer 3 because the architecture can be the same.
Who knows? We may still have some 2600 series routers kicking around out there. Who knows? Could be.
Yeah, and there are architectures that explicitly work around caching, right? Lisp is one, right? And there are others. There are things in the MANET world that work specifically around caching, and it's something you just have to be aware of. It's not right or wrong. It's just it's
something
out there
to consider.
It's a potential problem.
Absolutely. Yeah, especially at scale when you're dealing with larger scale,
especially
and finite table sizes. Larger. Yeah,
yep, exactly.
Okay, Russ. Now you mentioned trade-offs earlier, and I think that is a great point for us to review and then maybe conclude on. The idea of trade-offs is that whenever you're making a decision to hide information, there is something you're giving away. If you're giving up, granularity, maybe you've now given up some information that you could have used to make a forwarding decision, and so on. So there's lots of trade-offs here that are worth mentioning, perhaps. Can you raise some of those issues for us?
Sure. So a classic example is I aggregate routing information, and I'll tell you, a really classic example is BGP route reflectors. And this is actually a form of aggregation most people don't think about, is that I have 5 eBGP speakers. And those 5 eBGP speakers are receiving routes, receiving the same destination and the same AS path and all the same attributes and everything. And they ship them all up to the route reflector. And their route reflector says, this is the best path for me, and ships it back to the 5 speakers. In fact, it ships it to every speaker in the entire AS. Well, it may get over to some other side of the network, and it may choose the route reflector maybe 2 hops away from one edge and 10 hops away from the other edge. But then it may reach some other router in the network, some BGP speaker, and that BGP speaker may be 10 hops away from the best path for the route reflector and 2 hops away from some other exit point. But it's never going to learn about that other exit point because the route reflector is actually aggregating the routing information from 5 views of that route to 2. Or 1, sorry, 1, most of the time, unless you have, best path alternate or something on, add paths or something like that. So this is a classic example of suboptimal routing. And this is why add paths and next best path and all this other stuff came out, was because people realized this was a problem. There was actually a solution that was put out for a while about calculating from the perspective of each BGP Route Reflector client and sending each client a different route.
It's interesting because of this has to do with the BGP best path algorithm and how that's determined and the information that is passed along from the Route Reflector. So in this classic problem you're describing, it's the presumption of the Route Reflector that not only does it know the destination, it knows the best way to get there.
It knows the best way to get to the next hop, which is not true. That's where you get into real trouble is the next stop, and specifically IGP metric, but there are others. Med could be something that may not be taken into account correctly or something like that, right? So this is pretty classic. I mean, when you remove information, you can, and I would say it's probably 80% of the time true. I don't know for certain. I mean, I haven't done like a research project on it or anything, but probably 80% of the time, you're going to lose some optimality. You're going to follow paths that you wouldn't be optimal to follow in the network. You're going to consume bandwidth, have additional hops, have additional latency because you remove information. It's just the trade-off. It is the way it is.
That'll depend on the complexity of the network as well, where you're doing your aggregation. If we're talking about route summarization, where you're doing that summarization, where the information is hid, what options have been removed from the forwarding algorithm because you're hiding information, and then where that all settles in. Simpler networks, maybe not such a big trade-off. Yeah. The more complex and the more mesh a network is.
I mean, even you don't have to go to aggregation either. Another example that may be more appropriate or more common in smaller networks may be LSA timer tuning in OSPF or LSP backoff timers in ISIS in a network that's running voice over IP. Or something that is very, very like even a high-speed trading network, right? Where you set your backoff timers so that you converge less often. But in converging less often, you're actually causing your micro loops to last longer.
As opposed to setting some sub-second timer to force faster convergence, you're going the other
That's
way.
Exactly
there's a trade-off. Yeah.
Right. So you're increasing jitter in your network by reducing the convergence speed. Okay. It's a trade-off. I don't know which is the right answer. It just depends on your application.
Yeah, and the big point here is just to remember information hiding solves problems, but there's a cost to everything that you do. Yeah,
there's a trade-off. There is a cost. It's a trade-off. Yeah. I think we said that.
We did. but I wanted to conclude on that point just to remind people that it's not as if network design has this one right answer to everything. There are so many considerations that go into making a particular decision. And as we're saying here, Russ, trade-offs. Okay, if I do this, set sub-second timers, maybe I get faster convergence, but I've just asked my control plane to do a lot more work.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's a trade-off. Is it worth it? Maybe. Maybe it's the right answer in your environment, but maybe not. Yeah. And you need to think through all of those scenarios.
Yeah, exactly.
So in our book here, Computer Networking Problems and Solutions, this was chapter 19, one of Russ's chapters. Then there's another chapter, chapter 20, that's examples that get into specific scenarios.
They're all our chapters.
They're all our chapters. Sure. I love that you believe that. So the following chapter on this information hiding talks about examples of information hiding, talking about ISIS, OSPF, BGP, segment routing, and more, so you can think through the different scenarios, think about the trade-offs, understand what's really going on under the hood there. And then the whole book is filled in with things like this. Another thing, Russ, that we did with these chapters, there's review questions at the end, so you can begin to think through. And they're not all obvious. It's not like, oh, if I go back three pages to this paragraph, the answer's in there. I mean, there's some of that, but a lot of them are intended to make you think. So in the chapters that I got into, I wrote questions where there was no obvious answer in the book. You had to take the information in the chapter, think about it, and then formulate an answer, you know, to the question. So the book is intended to make you think as well. And then there's a lot of footnotes for more information. And then a long list of information for you to go and read. Well, read this RFC, read this paper, read this, you know. So there's lots more of that in there as well. So lots and lots of info.
So I think what Ethan is saying is if you want something to read for the rest of your life.
This book is kind of that. It 830 odd pages that it came out to, with all of this, you know, more information you could read beyond. So it is, it's quite a tome. And I guess
so one of my happiest things about this book is there are people have found errors, by the way, typos and stuff like that.
Yes.
But a professional mathematician has actually read this book and not found that many mistakes.
Okay.
How's that for?
So she obviously we're
pseudocode, but you know, it's okay.
So we hope you learned something on the podcast, and we hope it illustrates the point that the way we wrote the book, it would hopefully be helpful to you. And yeah, we want you to buy the book. That's pretty straightforward of what we would like to happen as a result of this. And hope you don't mind.
Buy 10 copies, give them to your friends.
There you go. There you go. There'll be a link in the show notes to the book, again, Computer Networking Problems and Solutions by Russ and myself, Ethan Banks. And Russ, again, he's written a lot of books, some of the more recent ones, Navigating Network Complexity, Next Generation Routing with SDN Service Virtualization and Service Chaining, that you wrote with Jeff Tansura, who's been on the podcast before as well. And then The Art of Network Architecture, Business-Driven Design, which was written with Denise Donahue, who was also has been on the show and was one of our panelists on the virtual design clinic we did back in March. And Russ, your blog, rule11.tech, you're still a very, I follow your blog, of course, and it's your volume is admirable, sir. You write a lot of blogs.
Yes, but come on. You know, I post 10 worth readings a week, which I don't write those. So
fair enough. There's still a lot of original content that you're putting there. And then of course also you got the video podcast and the community over at thenetworkcollective.net. You're doing there with Jordan and Yvonne. So lots of good stuff, resources from Russ. And Russ, I think I'm going to close the show here. This seems like a good place for us to stop.
Seems like a good place to stop to me.
All right. Well, thank you, all of you, for listening to the Packet Pushers Priority Queue today. This and many more of our fine and free technical podcasts, along with our community blog, that's all at packetpushers.net. And, of course, our new membership site, Ignition, has been launched. You can visit that at ignition.packetpushers.net. Tweet to us at Packet Pushers. You can follow us at LinkedIn. And if you would, take a minute, rate us on Apple Podcasts. We'd appreciate that, as it does manipulate the magical Apple Podcast algorithm and somehow makes things better for us when you rate us highly. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.